Ira Israel is the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Path to Authenticity and Awakening.
The only people who are happy are the people who have wonderful relationships and who know their vocations. Voco in Latin means calling, what their purpose is. And the people who do jobs because they're paid an excessive amount of money, but they don't love the jobs, they go home and they anesthetize themselves with alcohol and television. And then they have to get up in the morning and do it all again. And their dream is to put a couple of bucks in the bank and then they'll retire and they won't have to sell their souls anymore. What I'm telling people to do is like find out who your authentic self really is and construct a life around that.
I talk with Ira Israel about forces that keep us from authenticity and what it takes to discover our authentic self. It's time for Progressive Spirit. Be right back. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website again is progressivespirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network, PRX, the public radio exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schock. Ira Israel is a licensed professional clinical counselor and a licensed marriage and family therapist. He's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, has 3 graduate degrees and 28 years of experience working in various capacities with award-winning filmmakers, musicians, artists, and writers. He's the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Path to Authenticity and Awakening. Welcome, Ira Israel, to Progressive Spirit.
It's a pleasure to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about this book, How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult. How'd this get started?
Well, I noticed epidemics of depression and anxiety in our culture. And I just, as I write in the book, I'm not the person who thinks that there's some rogue genes just afflicting Americans. So what I wanted to do was raise consciousness around all the things that we consider to be normal in our culture, such as capitalism, romantic love, psychology, everything, our school system, and see if those systems didn't have some underlying ramifications that were affecting people and causing them to be depressed or be anxious, because really they are epidemics in our culture.
In the foreword to your book, give me the author's name.
Catherine Woodward Thomas. Catherine Woodward Thomas, who wrote Calling in the One and A Conscious Uncoupling.
She wrote the foreword, and she said there's kind of a horizontal way and a vertical way. Sometimes therapy enables us to try to live in the world as it is, but there's also a part that's more important that I think you're getting to, is that we need to also challenge the way the world is and recognize that we're unhealthy because of an unhealthy world.
So personally, I espouse Advaita Vedanta. I don't know if you're familiar with that or...
No, I haven't heard that phrase. What is that?
So there's 6 darshanas in Hinduism. Three of them are some form of Vedanta. Advaita Vedanta, Vishishta Advaita Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta. And then the rest have to do with yoga and things like that. So there's 5 basic terms in Vedanta, the end of the Vedas, that come out of the Upanishads. And this is what my spiritual understanding of the universe is based on. So the first term is Brahman. And the best translation I've ever heard of that is that without attributes, meaning that if you can think it, it's not it. And it's the same thing in our culture with G-D in the Judeo-Christian Bible, you know, God or mystery. It's beyond human comprehension. Uh-huh. So Brahman is the first term. And the second term is Atman, which best translate, it's a soul. And then the third term is samsara, which is the wheel of reincarnation. And then the fourth term is maya, which is I like to translate as illusory. Just think like everything has an ephemeral quality. Everything is passing. Everything is, you know, illusory. And then the last term is karma, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is the law of action and reaction. So the tools of meditation and yoga, which I go into in the book, were devised and designed to help us transcend Maya, all that we perceive through our five senses, and realize that Atman equals Brahman, that we're all divine, we're all God, we're all children of God, we're all whatever you believe is your higher self, your higher power, that's all interconnected in the world. So for me, it's just a philosophy, an understanding of the world. And if you study quantum physics, and you'll notice that there are distinct similarities between everything from the Hindu and Buddhist tradition and what we're discovering now.
Thou art that. And
exactly.
And what that does is it enables us to kind of step back and recognize that we are not our thoughts, not our feelings, that there's a deeper aspect, a deeper or higher, I don't know how you, however we put the metaphor, but and that gives us a real freedom, doesn't it?
Well, it's a fascinating thing. Nietzsche wrote, what if only the worst and most superficial thoughts rose to consciousness? You know, my cat, who we were talking about before the show, she goes through life perfectly fine without the self-reflexivity that we have. So in my book, what I'm looking at is, you know, there's a beautiful quote by Jacques Lacan. He says, "Language thinks me." Right? So our mind fools us into thinking that it can think all these things, but actually with all the, depending on what statistics you listen to, we have a very limited number of thoughts every day, and most of them are the same as yesterday, and most of them are negative. The mind has a negativity bias. So my book was designed to try to get people to look at their operating system and, you know, make some tweaks or hacks to, you know, get rid of some of those negative voices in their heads, because no human being was ever born with a voice that says, I suck at this, I'll never amount to anything, all my relationships fail, blah, 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 blah. We're not born with language. You know, we're born with some kind of subconscious way of chunking up the world in terms of space and time, but we're not born with language. So for me as a psychotherapist, when I'm sitting in my office and I'm listening to these fairly successful people with this like wide array of self-doubts and low self-esteem, I keep on saying, hey, whose voice is that? You know, how, you're the president of X. Like, how could you, you know, like, what do you mean? Like, you know, so that's my curiosity led me into trying to understand how human consciousness got to the way it is now.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. I want to talk about depression too, but let's talk about, first of all, this development of negative self language. And that actually, as I understand what you're saying, started out as a positive thing, a survival technique.
Exactly. So, you know, parenting is the most difficult job in the world. There's no such thing as a perfect parent. And most cultures that we consider to be uncivilized third world countries, they nurse their babies. The babies are on the mother's breast in a satchel, sleeping with the parents until 4 or 5 years old. So we do this thing in America called the individuation process, because what our school system is designed to do is to make workers. And so, you know, like science and medicine, where, you know, you get the baby off of the breast in 18 months, if it's ever on it. And, you know, with the exception of people who do attachment parenting, they're, you know, your kids are away from you and your kids are at school. And what I'm looking at is there something really traumatic about a baby sleeping in its own room when it's 2 weeks old? Isn't that kind of terrifying for a baby that knows it's going to die if it's not clean, if it's not safe, if it's not fed? You know, why do babies cry so much, like when you're alone in the dark in a separate room, or when you drop them off for school the first time and you drive away and your kid is like, you know, goes into some sort of panic attack? You know what, like, so again, I'm looking at human beings as animals, and then what we consider to be, you know, productive in terms of our American version of capitalism.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. There was a statistic that you put out there that I shouldn't be surprised about, but it was good to see it. You wrote that, and it's getting back to this idea of the compliant worker. 56% of contributors to the DSM-5 mm-hmm. are connected with the pharmaceutical industry. In other words, we are creating, in a sense, diagnoses such as perhaps, and I don't know, I don't want to overstate what you're stating, but depression, for example, and the cure for that is to make us workers, that we're, it's being diagnosed in a faulty way. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. As sentient beings, what I believe is we have one primary desire, and that is to be loved unconditionally. And we grew up in this crazy society which only gave us tools to gain love conditionally, because we speak well, because we're rich, because we're sexy, because we drive a certain car, because we take vacations in exotic places. And we're constantly seducing people into liking our false selves, our facades, our personas, our outer selves. But what we really crave is them to just love us for just being on planet Earth for these 80 years and just being, you know, a human being. So America is a giant resentment factory. And to me, that's one of the root causes of resentment, because we're constantly doubting the love of other people, because they're falling in love with parts of us that we really don't want them to fall in love with. I mean, nobody, it's funny, on internet dating, you know, people show their six pack abs, or they, I don't know what they do, but like, I always imagine if you had a series of weddings that related to like what the first images of these people are, like, will you take this man who drives a blank and vacations in whatever, and you know, the women talk about how independent they are and these other things, crazy busy. It's fascinating that the self that we choose to present to the world. And then we wonder why there is this epidemic of depression, because we want, and then again, the whole book is about authenticity. So in all, I'm just provoking people into showing up in a more authentic, loving, vulnerable, compassionate manner so they can get the love that they really want.
So we show the face that we want to present to the world, and then people might say they like that, give us positive affirmation for that, and then we're bummed out that they don't like us because they like the face.
Right. No. I mean, it's funny. Like, after a marriage, you'll see, sex goes down. Somebody puts on a couple of extra pounds. Eventually, you know, the one of them will turn to the other one and say, like, you wouldn't even be here if I weren't a millionaire. Like, you wouldn't even be here if I didn't take care of all your sexual needs. You know, and so again, we're very confused as a species, and our culture is not as advanced as many people would think it is.
Well, we're pretty good with the technology part, but yeah. Putting that to life, and I want to talk about that in a little bit. Ira Israel is my guest. He is the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult. The subtitle is A Path to Authenticity and Awakening. And you begin your book with the definitions of authenticity that are somewhat troubling. You know, I want to be my authentic with you, and it's basically an excuse to insult someone or dismiss them, right?
Yeah.
Talk about the structure of your book, and
sure,
as well as authenticity and wrong ways to understand it as well as right ways.
So I examine authenticity psychologically, colloquially, sociologically, philosophically, the way we understand it in our culture. And I want people to question again, does language create reality? And if so, then in you choosing your language, are you choosing or creating your reality? And is that reality conducive to attracting the love, you know, that you want? So the only thing that correlates strongly with happiness is the quality of our intimate relationships. And the thing that I believe is that the number one thing that correlates strongly with secure intimate relationships is authenticity, how authentic we can be. And that's why attachment theory is a key component of authenticity, because we have these, you know, the human mind is a fascinating thing. It basically assimilates traumas from, you know, the first day you're born, your whole life, and things in the past. And it projects them into the future, because what it's trying to do is stave off potential future trauma. So your mind is worrying about things, or it's planning, if this happens, making contingency plans and doing all these hypothetical things kind of in the background. And what I'm finding, or, you know, the theory of the book is that your mind creates fears, prejudices, resentments, and expectations that are hindering you now from showing up authentically in the loving relationships that you want. So during your whole childhood, and I believe that the way we individuate children in this culture is very traumatizing. You know, I know very few people who came out of, you know, baseball, football, our public school system, unscathed. You know, there's some kind of horrible humiliation, or this happened to me, or even like my parents got divorced, something that wasn't the child's fault, but they assimilated as, if I had been perfect, my parents wouldn't have gotten divorced. If I had been perfect, then this would have happened, this would have happened, or that would have happened. So, you know, I'm really interested in finding out how we perceive authenticity. And then in the second part of the book, what I do is I reconstruct it in terms of attachment, atonement, attunement, presence, and congruence. So attachment is just attachment theory. And there's a beautiful quote by Harville Hendrix that helps explicate why I'm so interested in this. He says that the subconscious purpose of marriage in America is to enable us to complete our childhoods. Our parents had deficits. Those deficits wounded us. Those wounds became defense mechanisms, and those defense mechanisms became our personalities. And we'll always be attracted to people who can replicate the dynamics from one or more of our primary caregivers. So what I'm saying is that there's a wounded child in all of us who's retroactively, or trying to retroactively, gain the approval, acceptance, and love from their primary caregivers. You know, I mean, more specifically, I say in the book, we become what we love and we become what we hate, and both are inauthentic, you know, because we want our parents to love us. So we learn how to use a fork and we smile and we get good grades, but then we want to individuate. So we get a mullet, get a tattoo, use the F word, you know, do things to say to them, I'm not you, I'm autonomous, you can't control me, even if you're paying my rent, even if you're feeding me, blah, blah, blah. So you know, we're very conflicted in a way, and I want to raise that to consciousness. The second part of authenticity is atonement, or at-one-ment, and that's releasing our resentments about things we can't change. So if you walked into your home today and saw your child trying to jam a square peg into a round hole, you would stop them. And yet this is what your mind does all day long. It's trying to change the past. It's trying to change things that it can't change. It wants you to have a better, you know, something. So there's a beautiful quote by Lily Tomlin who says, forgiveness means giving up all hope of having a better past. So that's why the logical conclusion of my book is to forgive everybody, because you're only causing your own suffering by being unwilling to forgive. The third part of authenticity is attunement, which is being able to connect in person with other people. I write that mirror neurons do not fire via text message. One hug equals 1 million Facebook likes. And as you were just saying, John, we delude ourselves into thinking that we're connecting through Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, all these things. But what we really need, we need hugs. We need to throw a frisbee on the beach. We need to chat with other people. We need to stand next to a loved one in a museum and look at beauty and talk about how it moves us. And you know, we need really to learn how to reconnect. We're tribal in nature. And yet, you know, more people live alone in Manhattan than live with other people. You know, we're just growing more and more alienated as a the guy who wrote Bowling Alone, John Putnam, he says, you know, the prizes of our society, the big house with the fence and the guard and the children all have separate rooms, that causes, it foments alienation. And to me, to answer your original question 15 minutes ago, that's what's showing up as depression, because I've never had anyone come into my office and say, I feel loved, supported, respected by all of my friends, family, and coworkers, and I'm depressed. So the things that we think are connecting us in our culture are really alienating us. And then the fourth part of authenticity is presence, not letting our mind drag us into the past or drag us into the future. The tools I espouse are yoga and meditation. And then the last part of the book is on congruence. And that's having our outer world match our inner world. So we're living in this incredibly privileged time when we get to decide who we want to be and how we want to show up and what type of lives we want to lead. And then, you know, what I want people to do is find the tools to have those lives and live in integrity and, you know, really keep themselves at the high end of the happiness spectrum. So the thing that you probably noticed first in the book was the epitaph, which was André Gide, who said, "It is better to be hated for who you are than to be loved for who you are not."
Ira Israel speaking there. How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Path to Authenticity and Awakening is the name of the book. This is Progressive Spirit. I'm John Shuck. So let's talk a little bit more, that we got the outline, we got the skeleton, about some specifics here. So you mentioned when someone comes to you depressed, and what the industry wants is to give us pills. And right. And in some cases, I'll just ask you this, are in some cases for depression, that is a correct.
Absolutely. On the other hand, you have to look at the barometer or metric of mental health in our culture. And normally, if you really analyze the DSM, which is our Bible for diagnosing people, the barometer of mental health in our culture is, can you show up for work? And yeah. I really think we have to question that, because, you know, these pills that are blocking your brain from doing certain things, you know, so that you can show up at work. Not really, you know, a lot of people are catatonic in bed. They need something for a week or two to get out of bed. That's fantastic. You know, if you can mask the symptoms or cover them up so that the body can rejuvenate and you can come out of that ahead, that's fine. But what I'm finding is that people are on cocktails of Paxil, Prozac, Xanax for 10, 15, 20 years. And then all of a sudden, you know, when they even think of getting off of them, they're terrified because they don't want to go back to that time when they were severely depressed. So, you know, there's always things to consider. And no, I'm not 100% against drugs. You know, if you need to show up for your concert, if you need to do something and you're depressed and you cannot spend 3 days with your psychotherapist trying to figure out why you're depressed, if it's just like this overwhelming blanket of depression, then of course take the medication, but just know what it's for and then try to do it for a limited time.
Because the medication ultimately, as you say, kind of numbs us, right? It takes those edges off, which is it feels like a better thing than really feeling bad. But it also, as you mentioned, makes us a little bit more of robots, a little bit more what? Accepting of whatever people dish out. I'm thinking, and I just want to see what you think about this. Since 9/11, for example, we have been paraded, herded through the airport security system. Our faces are down. We're just like afraid of everything. And I often challenge people, don't you think that's rather odd? Oh, no, we have to do that. You know, and I'm thinking, is that part of just accepting this fear, big world of fear as it is?
Well, for me, I always use the story about living in Manhattan in the 80s. So I lived in Manhattan, and you had like five locks on your door, and there was a baseball bat in the corner. And then if you were of the inclination, you would have a gun in your, you know, next to your bed, and you'd just be terrified of break-ins. And so when I'm teaching at Esalen and other people and other places, I'll ask the students, I'll say, raise your hand if your front door is unlocked right now. Raise your hand if your car door is unlocked right now. We live in such a degree of fear. I mean, we're in fight or flight mode most of our waking hours. And so again, meditation, yoga, anything you can do to take yourself out of fight or flight mode for some amount of time and just get one clean, loving breath and realize that it's, you know, that what we consider to be normal is crazy.
Well, let's go again. I'm going to get with depression one more time, because I am depressed every now and then, but I actually find it sometimes to be a gift, you know, because there's a reality to that. I mean, it's a time of, we call it depression, but there's also a spiritual aspect of that, right? It's a time to rest your body, to recognize that all of the junk you're receiving is not healthy. It's a time to kind of process all that.
Well, our paradigm that we live in currently for the last 45 years is the one psychologically of a cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. So in that paradigm, our belief system is that emotions don't arise ex nihilo. Emotions are always arising because of thoughts. Thoughts precede emotions. That's our paradigm. I'm just saying what it is. So you don't just spontaneously have this overwhelming depression. What happens is you're thinking, oh, no one's called in a week. Like, nobody cares about me. I could die today and I wouldn't find my body for a month. And your mind just goes into this spiral. And you that to me is really one of the main causes of depression. The second one that's really fascinating is grief. And particularly, and I write about this extensively in the book, we're not allowed to grieve in this culture. You know, like your child, if something terrible happens and you call your boss and you say, I'm so sorry, you know, my child was walking in the street and was hit by a car. Like your boss is like, oh, that's terrible. Take 2 weeks off. I mean, you can never get over losing a child, period. It's just like the worst thing possible. And yet in our culture, we everything revolves around work. And so the DSM, the latest DSM-5, which came out, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, maybe a little longer, what they did, there was something called the bereavement exemption, where if somebody's child was murdered, you would get 2 weeks off they would give you a month before they would diagnose you with depression. And if you had all those symptoms continuously, you know, months later, then you would be diagnosed with depression. But they eliminated the bereavement exemption in the fifth DSM. And the quote was that they found, the psychiatrist found that the same pharmaceuticals that treat depression also work on grief. And to me, that's disgusting. That's horrifying. You know, like when someone's, you're never going to see this person again, they died or they were killed or they OD'd or something. Like we don't have good rituals in our culture to grieve people, you know, to grieve those losses. And we're losing things all the time. But again, you know, you can always find you can always go into your psychiatrist's office and get some kind of pharmaceutical to prop you up at your desk.
Wow. That's amazing that was said, and that's what you just said. So grief has suddenly become something you can fix with a pill.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
I'm John Schack. This is Progressive Spirit. I'm speaking with Ira Israel, author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Path to Authenticity and Awakening. More to come. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm and click donate. I'm speaking with Ira Israel. He's the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Path to Authenticity and Awakening. This is Progressive Spirit. I'm John Schack. Let's say we suffer a trauma like that and a great loss, and because it's so available, we got what you just said, 20 million Americans on antidepressants, and you go to your doctor, you go to your counselor, whatever, and they say, here, this will take the edge off. Okay, so eventually you want to go deeper and say you really want to deal with the grief and let the grief be.
Yeah.
How as a counselor do you help people through that?
I feel that everybody has to find their own ritual to walk through the fire and to understand that reality is not going to show up the way that their mind expected it to. And again, the key component in at-one-ment is forgiveness. So there's a beautiful quote by Eckhart Tolle. He says, "You either change your life, you either accept your life or change it. Any other position is insane." You either change your life or you either accept your life or change it. Any other position is insane. So again, my whole thing is about human consciousness, wanting things to be other than the way they are. You know, if you can't change something and you're complaining about it and fighting about it, I would be much happier if I were 6'5 and weighed 185 pounds and could slam dunk, you know, but I'm not 6'5, I'm 5'11 and I weigh more than that and I can't slam dunk. But so your mind is continuously is making these hypotheticals and that's the cause of your own suffering. These woulda, coulda, shoulda, didn't. So those are the things that interest me in terms of depression, in terms of, you know, processing the grief of the things that we lost, our hopes, our dreams, our ideals, our relationships, our loved ones. You know, children go off, the empty nest syndrome. You know, just all these things revolve around personal identity, who we are, who we want to be, who we think we should be, and then, you know, getting tools to keep us at the higher ends of our happiness ranges.
And it's not wrong to be sad about those things when they happen. It's just to be honest with how we feel, isn't it?
Of course. Everybody, and again, we have our bandwidth for emotions in our culture is incredibly thin. I write in the book, if you saw a man every day on the corner crying for a week, you know, you would call the police and they would call the short bus and they would put this person away, you know, but you would ask them, well, why are you standing on the corner crying? It's unseemly to us. It makes us feel uncomfortable. By the same token, if you saw an angry woman standing on the corner of Main Street screaming for a week, I don't even think it would last an hour. You would just call the police. The police would come over. They'd ask her a couple of questions. They'd call the short bus. They'd give her a 4-day vacation. They'd 5150 her, and she would be locked up in an insane asylum until they found out, like, why she was screaming. And if it was because, you know, God forbid somebody killed her daughter or something like that, it wouldn't matter. We don't accept emotions in our reality.
Yeah, and especially emotions that are gender what? For me, gender, tell me, give me the word describe that a little bit.
It's becoming a lot better now. Men, you know, and to me, there's a quote in the book. I say something funny like, 40 years ago, if you told my grandmother that someday there would be transgender bathrooms, gay people could marry, marijuana would be legal, and a black man would be president, she would have laughed you out of the room. But we are evolving in certain ways to allow men to have a wider range of emotions and not be so staid, and, you know, we're the warriors and the workers and things like that. And women are also, specifically with the Me Too movement, which is unbelievable and wonderful, you know, they're getting angry, because they've been violated, they've been oppressed, they've been taken advantage of, they've been exploited, and there's been a lot, they're putting their foot down and just saying, it stops with me. Like, I'm not going to let this insanity continue on to my daughters.
There's an article that you wrote in the website, The Good Men Project. It's called How the Internet Engendered the Fall of Consumer-Based Capitalism and the Rebirth of Democracy, A Brief History of the Future. Tell me a little bit about that and the technology of the internet and what it's doing to us, I guess, positively and negatively.
Okay, so the article starts. I was literally like moved to tears last year. I read this article about this Navy captain. You know, Italy is in a terrible financial state, and there were these migrants, these people trying to escape, and they were all black from Nigeria, some South African country, and they were on some terrible boat, and the boat went down in the sea. And the Italians, who are living in a very tenuous financial situation, they decided that it was worth $9 million to recuperate the wreck and to give these 300 people proper burials. And the reason they did this is because the captain said, I ordered the Navy to recover the wreck to bury those brothers and sisters of ours who would otherwise have remained at the sea bottom forever. I did it because we Italians know the value of the word civilization. That to me is super intense. And again, your show is about social justice. So in our culture, giving someone a proper burial, having a name someplace that, you know, their next of kin are notified, that's a part of civilization. That's something that animals, you know, they can't do, they don't do. So I start the article with that, and I want to just examine the good things about having a civilization and order and peace and the luxury that we enjoy, and also, what's our next civilization? You know, if you walked up to, as I said in the book, if you walked up to a feudal lord 500 years ago and said, you know, someday you won't have serfs, someday there'll be factories and people will take horses to, or cars or buses to the factories, and they'll be paid in dollars, not in carrots and celery. So, you know, we don't know what our next society is going to resemble. I'm particularly, I'm of the opinion that His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the influence on compassion, I'm hoping that that is the next society, that we don't have to be so competitive. We don't, you know, as I write in the book, capitalism is based on Herbert Spencer's dictum, survival of the fittest. That was fantastic when we lived in, you know, with finite resources. But we're living in this world of abundance right now where we have the ability to feed all 8 million people, all 8 billion people on the planet, and 3.5 of them, almost half, will go to bed hungry tonight. There's something wrong with that. There's something wrong with people having $100 billion. You know, you can't eat any better. You can't dress any better. You can't wear that many jeans. You know, you just don't need that. So we used to have in the 1950s, according to Robert Reich, you know, we used to have taxes, and that we were basically like this kind of middle class. There was just a large middle class, and that's what drove our economy. And then what happened after Ronald Reagan was like there were deregulation started. And again, this is the premise of my book, is that power corrupts. And there used to be laws in place and regulations so that people couldn't get too powerful, like Donald Trump, or even I'll say this and people will hate me, but Bill Gates. You know, if his money had been taxed and he did not have a monopoly, then, you know, but right now he's man of the year for all the money he donates, which is great. But still, if you look at the system in general, there are things that can be improved upon, and we need to, you know, abolish the Electoral College. You know, there's no reason today why a person from Wisconsin, their vote should count 3.8 times more than my vote. We don't need that anymore. The Chad system of voting is totally antiquated. We can go to we can use the blockchain technology for Bitcoin, and we can all vote for our devices. And then hopefully what will happen is we won't need the Republican and Democratic parties anymore, because that's just, you know, this crony capitalism and people doing everything to run their campaigns, which is essentially like accepting bribes. It's all wrong. Our whole political system has been corrupted. So I wrote this article today because I think that one of the benefits of the internet, we've seen the Arab Spring, and we've seen the ability of marginalized people to communicate and find each other and then build a base and things like that. And again, for me, the Me Too movement is just so wonderful and great. And we need to capitalize on whether it's like, I forget the gentleman's name, Colin Kaepernick. You know, we either have to stand up together or kneel down together. But there's a hegemony in place right now. It's coming down. The old ways of slavery and exploitation, they're coming down. And so, you know, Eliot asked, does it end with a bang or a whimper? Are we going to have to go through a civil war? Are we going to have to go through a world war? Are there going to be massive assassinations? Is there going to be a bovine plague? What's going to have to happen to raise consciousness so that we move into the next society of compassion and authenticity, rather than the craziness of, you know, people working for 40 years, having a heart attack, you know, being addicted to opioids, doing all this craziness so we can work when nobody wants worked really hard on his tombstone. Everybody wants beloved. So why do we live in this crazy society where every day we're just like running ourselves into the ground to earn money?
All right. Ira Israel, his book is How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Path to Authenticity and Awakening. I subject myself every year, because I guess it's the religion of America to do so, and watch the Super Bowl and all of its commercials. And one of them was just really, it was just really amazing. Two of them, a car ad, and they people write, if you buy this car ad, suddenly you help people with cancer because whatever. And I'm thinking, well, why not just donate to cancer in the first place, car company?
I'll tell you about it. We feel there's a beautiful, beautiful, everybody should go to the YouTube and put in Slavoj Žižek, Slavoj Žižek, and then put in Starbucks. So he goes through, just like I do in my book, and I just love his, he most people will consider him to be insane in some ways, but he's super smart and he's very well read, and he's a truly great philosopher. And he says that Starbucks enables you to do something terrible and its opposite, something good in the one, you know, because they put on the wall that it's free trade, fair trade and free this and no whatever. So we've done this thing in America because there is this subconscious guilt that we feel. And that's what that's why it's a very touchy subject. But the whole Bill Gates situation, like, I don't think our country should have 501c3s. They're being taken advantage of. And Gore Vidal wrote about this in 1973. You know, all these churches and things that don't pay taxes, all these organizations that don't pay taxes and then, you know, bring malaria nets from China to Africa, but, you know, they don't have to pay taxes on this money. I don't know. There's some kind of search for redemption in all of these things. I mean, there's a lot of great people doing a lot of wonderful things, but I've written on the internet several times, all philanthropy, real philanthropy, is done anonymous. You don't want people to know about it. You don't want to be like, you give and then you give more and then you give more and you shut up. You don't tell people about it because, again, social justice, the root of it is trying to make a world a better place for everybody. And if you're out there doing ego gratifying things like saying, I'm making the world a better place for everyone, you're not making the world a better place for everyone. Just do the work, show up, be your higher self, and be as compassionate and loving in all of your interactions as you can be.
Don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. It's a substitution of the promise of charity, not even charity itself, the promise of charity instead of justice, right? And we're also deluded in that it somehow, if we make the billionaires rich, it'll all trickle down with benevolent blessings to everyone else. I mean, it's a similar principle. Capitalism doesn't care about justice. It cares about this fake charity, you know?
Yeah. It's fascinating. As I said, you know, we have a choice in every interaction, whether we listen to our higher self, which is going to choose love all the time, or our fear-based side, which is our ego, and that's going to say, no, I need more, I need this, I need that. Like, what does he have? Why does Johnny have a Lamborghini? I only have a Maserati. You know, your ego is trying to gain just some sort of, you know, fleeting, you know, it's a hedonic treadmill. And all the things that you think will make you happier, yeah, your ego will make you happy, will not make you happy. All those things. Like, the only people who are happy are the people who have wonderful relationships and who know their vocations. Voco in Latin means calling, what their purpose is. And the people who do jobs because they're paid an excessive amount of money, but they don't love the jobs, they go home and they anesthetize themselves with alcohol and television. And then they have to get up in the morning and do it all again. And their dream is to put a couple of bucks in the bank and then they'll retire and they won't have to sell their souls anymore. What I'm telling people to do is, like, find out who your authentic self really is and construct a life around that, rather than doing some crazy thing that you saw in movies when you were in high school. Like, if I become rich, then I'll get a wonderful spouse and we'll have 2.3 kids and she'll drive a Subaru and I'll drive a Porsche and my kids will go to great colleges. What I'm saying is that, yeah, your kids will go to great colleges now and you'll end up $400,000 or they'll end up $400,000 in debt and the whole system has gone off the rails.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about it. I've, you know, talked with people, whistleblowers of various, you know, places and whatnot. And I found that many of them, it really was a spiritual quest, because when they got the courage to kind of do what they had to do, vilified in many cases, as you said, it's better to be hated for who you are than loved for who you are not, that there really was a sense of increased happiness, even though, I mean, it doesn't mean that oftentimes they felt great opposition and faced that, and it was a big struggle, but nonetheless there was a sense of you might say, like you say, authenticity. Tell me some positive stories of people who you know who have been able to come through.
I do this thing at Esalen in between my workshops called drive-through therapy, where I give everyone 10 minutes. And something just happened yesterday, which like made me just stop and cry. So someone just posted on their Facebook page that, and the person is a very high up person at I think it's now it's the second biggest company in America. I don't want to name names or anything. And so we do this drive-through therapy, and I'm authentic. I'm authentic to a fault. So she was telling me how her job had become somewhat less satisfying and things like that. And so there's this thing announcing on on Facebook the other day. She said, "I want to thank Ira for his drive-through therapy. He told me two things: one, be the best mother I could be, and two, do some research development to find what'll feed my soul." So I went down to halftime, and I am starting a course to become a doula because I've always been interested in the birth process. I might not actually become a doula, but you know, I've cut my hours to halftime at this company, and I'm going to, you know, follow my dreams. And there was all these comments about it, and it's just like, you know, as I said, we're taught these things like what's the measure of success when we're in high school. And it turns out that all those things, you know, we live in this country where you have the inalienable right to pursue happiness. And that is a surefire way to misery. If you're pursuing happiness, particularly in the breed of another person's version of success. So you have to look into your heart. You have to find what works for you. And, you know, hopefully it'll be like being of service to others, become a doula, you know, teach meditation, take people on hikes in the Andes, you know, but sitting behind a desk, pushing numbers on a screen, it doesn't make people happy.
Tell me a little bit about mindfulness and the mindfulness industry. Positive and negative things, because there's on one level, obviously being mindful is a good thing and practicing of meditation, but there's also a sense in which even a good thing can be corrupted.
People are going to say, what are you, some sort of socialist or communist? But in America, we've done to yoga and mindfulness what Domino's did to pizza, what Starbucks did to coffee. We take out the kernels. So the mindfulness movement in America is horrifying to me because they're selling calmness, but they're removing it from its Buddhist or Hindu or even Christian or Jewish roots most of the time. And there's a couple of places in my town that have secularized, and the people told me, you cannot mention Buddha, you cannot mention any God or anything if you teach here, blah, blah, blah. And it's funny because, you know, without that paradigm, without that matrix of beliefs, yes, of course, you can sit there and concentrate on your breath and gain calmness, but the people don't know why. So for me, mindfulness is it's a great form of meditation, but you have to know the distinction between that Buddhist tradition and the Hindu. So for me, in Hinduism, as I expressed before, we meditate in order to transcend Maya. And one of the aspects of the mind is that you can't tell it what not to speak. And another aspect is that you can't shut it off. So what you have to do is find a focal point in some ways, or an anchor, and you concentrate on that, whether it's your breath or a mantra or walking or something. And then you'll find, if you concentrate on that long enough, like that hamster wheel in your head, which is telling you all this other stuff, will kind of dissipate and go away. And that's when the calm is. So it's interesting because what I've just described is from the Vedantic Hindu lineage of having us transcend our thoughts so that we can realize our inner divinity, which happens to be calm. You know, like God is calm, right? If you're realizing, if you're becoming at one for a couple of seconds with the divine, then you're going to be blissed out and calm. So Buddha wasn't born a Hindu the way Jesus was born a Jew, but after his search for the origins of pain, suffering, and death, he found that there was no self to transcend and there was no divine to transcend to. So he created mindfulness meditation, which is essentially trying to harness or train the mind and get it to do what you want it to do so it doesn't drag you around like wild horses. Which also, you know, if your mind is dragging you around like wild horses drag people around, then you're going to be neurotic. You're going to be depressed, you know. So, again, it's a tool so that you can gain a greater understanding and harness your mind. So I love the fact that people are talking about mindfulness and that mindfulness is going into corporations and things, but there's no disadvantage to learning about Buddhism. Buddhism is not a religion. As I say in the book, Buddhism is a prescription to alleviate suffering. Depression and anxiety are suffering. So what we call Buddhism and that the Buddha's prescription, the Four Noble Truths and the Eight Limb Path to alleviate suffering, is perfect for our culture.
Yeah. You mentioned mindfulness in corporations. Well, there, again, what's the purpose of this mindfulness practice? Is it to make us better workers, or is it to really move us to a deep sense of whatever? Use the ancient language, the divine, that thou art that, you know? That's what I'm thinking. Like you say, when it's stripped away from its roots, we tend to not do the work.
It's funny. We had that phrase from, it's a horrible phrase, but going postal. Is the phrase where about that postal worker that went into his office with a machine gun and killed everybody. So I think that mindfulness, one of the incentives to bring it into corporations is because, I mean, statistically it's effective. It'll help you, you know, just be happier. And if you're happier, you'll be happier about going to your job and doing the things that you have to do. But on the other hand, you know, we're really living in this very trepidatious culture where, you know, people do crack all the time and go postal. So, you know, having them have the tool to be able to calm themselves down and you know, learn how to take a walk or just do something besides work. Because, you know, as I write in the article, you know, we all get addicted to this crazy American dream, which forces many people to go into debt. The average mortgage is $222,000. The average student loan is $26,000. The average credit card debt is $4,000. And you lose your freedom when you're in debt, because when your mind is constantly thinking, oh, my monthly nut is $8,000. I got to pay for this and I got to pay for that and I got to pay for this and food costs this and I haven't taken a vacation in 3 years. And your mind is operating that, then you're a slave. And so what I'm trying to do in the book and trying to do in this article is just have people make healthier choices and realize that, you know, if you're buying into this whole system of pharmaceuticals, working 80 hours a week, getting depressed, not living your heart's dream, not being nourished, you know, being alienated, thinking that like the only respite that you have is to get drunk in front of your television 11 o'clock at night and then masturbate and go to sleep. Like that, our culture is just in a very dysfunctional place. And what I'm trying to do is bring it back to a more loving, compassionate place.
Good stuff. Ira Israel has been my guest. His book, pick it up, How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, website, iraisrael.com. Thank you for your work. Thanks for being with me today.
Thank you very much, John. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Progressive Spirit is heard every week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed every week through the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Thanks also to the following stations for carrying Progressive Spirit each week. WETS, Johnson City, Tennessee, WEHC, Emory, Virginia, WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina, Kutztown University Radio, Kutztown, Pennsylvania, KCEI, Taos, New Mexico, KACR, Alameda, California, WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin, KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon, KYAQ, Newport, Oregon, and KZ88, Kabul, Missouri. You can download Progressive Spirit for free on your favorite podcast app. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schock. Be well.